So hello and welcome to this podcast on behalf of the British Society for Heart Failure. It's a series that we've run under the Freedom from Failure F-Word series. I'm Janine Hogan. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sunny Call, a consultant in intensive care and respiratory medicine and lead respiratory consultant at Harefield Hospital, and Lawrence Humphreys-Davies, retired international oil broker, chair of the British Society for Heart Failure Patient Advisory Panel. People with heart failure more often than not present with breathlessness, either insidiously increasing symptoms or actually fighting for breath. Many patients are misdiagnosed with a respiratory illness before heart failure is investigated. But is it as simple, as binary as that? Comorbidities have a significant impact on health status, use of healthcare services, and mortality. How do we unpick heart failure from a range of coexisting conditions? Lawrence, may I start with you? Could you tell us a bit about your journey to heart failure diagnosis and how breathlessness affects you now?
Well, good morning. I had a heart attack in 2014, probably in the classic situation in the gym, felt unwell, out of breath, very sick. Previously, I'd always trained no pain, no gain, absolutely brilliant, out of breath, keep on pushing. Yeah. Heart attack, real awakening. I was stented. That was March 2014. By autumn 2014, I felt bubbling in my chest. I felt coughing. I felt asthmatic. I felt bronchial. And my GP, who very efficient, said, oh, yes, you've got really bad bronchitis. Let's give you some antibiotics. They didn't really work. So I went off and saw a bronchial consultant. And yes, you've got bronchitis. Terrible, terrible. You know, I was on treadmills and such like and assessed properly, I thought. Then 2015, I started to really wheeze. And I would find it very, very disconcerting that my lungs sounded like breathing through arrow at night when I was lying in bed. And I found that I was coughing all the time. And I found that I needed constant, you know, Vic rubs and, you know, such like. Well, anyway, another GP at the practice said, maybe you should go and see your heart guy. So I went off and saw the heart guy. This was 2016 by then, a full year later. And he goes, oh, we're terribly sorry, it's deteriorated, we've got to operate. So open heart surgery, repair of the mitral valve. That team didn't look me in the eye after the operation. The mitral valve repair had not been successful. But I was told, you'll get better. But I wasn't better. My lungs were still bubbling. I was still breathless. I was still nervous about going to sleep. I live alone. You know, some nights I go to bed and I think, will I wake up in the morning? Well, I did. Yeah, resilient. Yeah. 2016, I had the first operation in September. My GP in, I'm going to say May, 2017 said, I think you'd better go and see our local consultant. They're very good. So off I went, thinking, you know, it'd take months. Well, off I went, had tests. Week later, I think you'd better come in and see my boss tomorrow. So in I went, met this lovely cardiologist, and he said, basically, you're scuppered. The operation's probably got to be done again. So in I go, 2017, July. I have second open heart mitral replacement this time, tricuspid repair this time. And I come out and I've got atrial fibrillation. So I have three atrial fibrillation operations. And that results in the insertion of a pacemaker in October 2017. Somewhere between that second operation and the atrial fibrillation, final insertion of the pacemaker, I heard for the first time the word heart failure. It had never really been mentioned before, because when you have a heart attack, you think you have a heart attack. You don't know about heart failure. You don't, it doesn't even come on the page of, you know, I have a heart problem, it's a heart attack. The heart's weak because of the heart attack.
Lawrence, who mentioned heart failure to you? Who was it that eventually said heart failure?
To be honest, I can't remember, but I would imagine it was probably my lovely cardiologist, 44 years old, respected, loved by everyone he works with, you know, dynamic, switched on. But there are plenty of GPs, bless them, who don't know about heart failure and who will diagnose it as bronchitis rather than heart failure. And there are plenty of so-called cardiologists who don't know too much about heart failure.
Lawrence, yeah. Are you still breathless? Are you still fighting for breath on occasion?
I mean, for instance, I've had a chest infection the last 5-6 weeks. And I go to the GP and she says, you've got a chest infection. And I'm quite prepared to say, I've got a chest infection. And because I have heart failure, it's tougher to shake off. So I'm on antibiotics for 5 days or something. I do feel better. This was now 2 weeks ago. So the last 5 weeks, I've been wheezing a little bit. I up my diuretic pills because I know that short term I can do that. So I went up 50% and took 3 instead of 2. It doesn't make me rush to the lavatory, but it does get rid of the liquid. Yeah. Now I've got, it's almost like breathing through another mask, to put it in perspective. I'm not wearing a mask now, but when I breathe, I have that extra layer of gunk in my lungs to go through, but I'm not bubbling with it. And I'm going to go to a warm climate for the next couple of weeks. And so hopefully that will dry it out and I'll come back. But if I come back and I'm still bubbling at all, I will go to my GP. I'd rather go to my heart cardiac nurse. But because I was discharged now nearly 2 years ago, I'm a little bit nervous to go back into the system because I don't want to be a problem. And the other thing is, first line of defense, I've always been taught, is the GP.
Lawrence, do you find that increasing breathlessness has been a barometer of increasing deterioration with your heart failure in the past?
It's 100% what governs my life. I get up in the morning. I know that walking 200 yards is fine. If there's a slope, I know that I'll take it a lot slower than other people. If it's sunny, I might walk on the shady side because I find that easier. But I definitely find, for instance, after lockdown, first lockdown, I was doing 10,000 steps in a sort of Van Gogh-like style around my back garden in a figure eight. Second lockdown, I thought, what's the point? We're going to have to, you know. So my exercise went down from, let's say, 10,000 steps a day to 4,500 steps a day. And my breathing and my lungs have suffered as a result. My stamina isn't as good as it was.
Thank you, Lawrence. Sunny, may I ask you, how much heart is in the lung? What is the prevalence of heart failure disease in COPD?
Morning, both, and thank you for having me to contribute to this very valuable discussion. I might just firstly say a lot of what Lawrence has shared with us today and many elements of it will resonate with lots of patients and clinicians around the country. There are various parts of those stories that I would see on a regular basis, and I think is something that's worth highlighting at a much higher level to be taken more seriously and looked into more deeply. To answer your question, it is difficult to differentiate, for clinicians, and this goes to Lawrence's point as well, to differentiate sometimes and quantify the relationship between conditions which share the same symptomatology. So heart failure and COPD both can present with breathlessness. And how do you quantify exactly how much of each one is contributing to symptomology in the same patient. To give you an example, if you look at the ECLIPSE study, then something like 7% of all COPD patients had heart failure. If you look at other studies, 39% of outpatients with heart failure had COPD, and they're associated with a shorter time to hospital admission and a substantially increased risk of death. Patients with diastolic dysfunction admitted for COPD exacerbations stay in hospital for longer, and they have more exacerbations. We published a national COPD audit some years ago, and that showed, and that was in the acute phase, and that showed around 40% of those patients had heart failure. So you've got two conditions, if you like, which share the same symptom and presentation. It therefore makes it difficult for the patient-facing clinicians, healthcare professionals, to differentiate and quantify the relationship. And therefore, targeted investigations are required, whether it's echo, whether it's ECG, whether it's BNP. And of course, very importantly, the management includes smoking cessation, optimal management of the other conditions that predispose to atherosclerosis, hypertension and diabetes, and of course, specific treatments for ischemic heart disease and of course, heart failure. So it's about the awareness. It's about knowing that these two conditions exist closely. It's about knowing that they have a common risk factor base. It's therefore knowing that then you then have to untangle and unpick the causes and the relative contribution of each one of those. And then that allows you better to calibrate your treatment and therefore personalize your treatment to the patient. And if your patient has, I don't know, I'm being slightly hypothetical here, 3/4 of symptomology you think is COPD and 1/4 is heart failure or vice versa, you calibrate accordingly. But you optimize both conditions rather than one, because the focus should be, the end point has got to be, how is my patient feeling and how do I alter their prognosis in a positive way, rather than I've just fixed myology and I've done what I can. And I think that joined up thinking is probably crucial to getting this right.
Thank you, Sunny. My next question is, how do we balance population health and the model of pathway-directed care? What do we need to be able to achieve this?
I mean, no patient wants to be a nuisance. And every patient is fearful of going and getting a worse diagnosis. So when I was told I had bronchitis, it actually quite suited me because I was able to say to myself, it's not my heart, it's bronchitis. So I didn't press and say, is it my heart? Could it be my heart? Because nobody wants to hear it's your heart. Because when you have a problem with your heart, you think you're going to die. When you have bronchitis, you think, oh, that's treatable. Oh, that's nothing. Yeah, right? So the patient pathway, the patient improvement, the patients have to learn and be shown by people like me that there isn't a need to be fearful of heart failure. You can cope with it. You can live with it. With the help of people like Sunny, you take medicines, you learn the process of gradual steps back to healthiness. I mean, I'm out of breath a bit now. I'm deconditioned right now. Yeah. 5 more minutes walking every day for the next week, 10 more minutes the next week, 1/2 hour the week after. And in 2 months, I might be striding out 2 miles, no problem at all. But it's not something I can do 2.5-3 miles straight away, hiking over the countryside. I know I wouldn't get that. So pathway is being realistic with what one can achieve and being supported along that way. And I feel so sorry for the people who are by themselves in situations where they're stressed for their health, stressed for their economic situation, and maybe stressed by family situations, and they have to prioritize those rather than their health. Those are the people I feel sorry for.
To Sally's point earlier, I'm wondering whether we're trying to get at the importance of linked data, education, new models of care delivery, rather than actually going for a single disease state or condition, trying very much to actually look at the patient more holistically.
I think integration is crucial to this. And I think also a quick word about commissioning. Commissioning has almost scuppered us here, because commissioning is for single pathways almost, and for single ways of doing things. And I don't have on record a single patient who fits into one of those pathways easily. Okay, that's the crazy thing about it. Patients come with a set of symptoms. You then make a set of diagnoses. And the way commissioning works, as I understand it, is that I'm only supposed to do my little bit. And then the patient has to be referred elsewhere or next door or wherever it happens to be to get all the rest done. I think this is cumbersome. I think this is, my patients come to me and say, I want this all done. If I ask them, I said, what's your idea of brilliant look like? You know, what's your idea of good look like? And they say, well, that you can fix all these things. And I say, I'll fix them. I will get your echo done. I'll get you seen by a cardiologist. I'll get your ECG done or a Holt or whatever it happens to be. I'll get your cardiac MRI done. I'll get your lung function done. I'll get your 6-minute walk done. I'll get your BNP done. I'll get your hemoglobin looked at. I'll get your bone profile looked at. I'll look at your bone density scan. We'll check your iron levels, B12, folate, vitamin D. There's nothing that says that we can't look at the whole of you and then appropriately get you sorted. And you want to do that as quickly as possible, rather than have to go back to base each time and then get referred out like a... this hub and spoke, of course, is very time consuming. And of course, people deteriorate in that time, and time is of the essence. So being able to fix more than one thing simultaneously, if you like, or at least in a stepwise fashion, minimizing delay, therefore improving their outcome, I think is fundamental to this. And commissioning, in a way, it narrows us into certain pathways and doesn't allow us to do certain things. And that is, it's almost like we've got it wrong. Commissioning is for patients rather than patients have to fit into commissioning pathways, if you see what I'm saying. And I think we need to think about it in the reverse order. What I think is also very important is a structural evaluation. It's about getting it into the psyche that, and I mean the commissioning psyche as well as the clinician psyche, that if you structurally evaluate your patient to find out what the causes are and the relative contribution of those causes to this patient's outcome and symptomatology, you can make a difference, which is far more reaching than if I put a patient, as Lawrence and I talk to each other, and I go, oh, well, you've got this condition and that's all you've got and that's all I can treat you for. Then I go all the way down this pathway as far as I can. And then he goes, well, I only feel 25% better or something like that, or 50%. And I have to go and go all the way back down again to see what else might be going on. Or I send you somewhere else and go, well, I've done what I can. I don't think that's satisfactory. I think in 2022, and I've been doing it 12 years my way, if you like, what I do seems to resonate with the patients. And hence I kept doing it. If it didn't, I'd have stopped it, And because it works so well, it drives people to carry on doing it. However, there are huge barriers to doing it, and you want to drop those barriers, and you want to make this easy for patients. You want to make this easy for clinicians, and the education is crucial. And of course, it isn't rocket science, and I don't think you need an RCT, though I'm lovely to do one, to show you that if I manage the whole patient, it's better than managing one condition to improve their overall health. That's like saying the sun's going to rise tomorrow morning, That's going to happen. If the sun rises and there's a bit more warmth, guess what? We'll all feel warmer. I mean, and I think it's about trying to break those barriers down and to appeal to the patient. At the end of the day, the patient at the center of this, and they want to feel better. And you just got to do what makes them feel better and therefore, find out what it is that's troubling them and then respond appropriately in that way.
Thank you, Sam.
And also, I think the more the patient knows and understands, the more they can do, firstly to help themselves, but also to help the doctors. Because if they know what feedback is appropriate, that saves an awful lot of time. if they know how to describe what's getting better, what's still bad, that saves an awful lot of time. And time is very precious in this. Firstly, to get a quick diagnosis. Secondly, to get a quick treatment process and a good result, all as quickly as possible. But the medical profession also need the feedback as quickly as possible.
Yes, quite. So the new heart failure pathway suggested by NHS England and NHS Improvement refers to patients. There is some recognition of the importance of breathlessness within heart failure, but it's presenting with acute breathlessness with a recommendation that those with a raised NT-proBNP have an echo within 24 hours. How helpful do you feel this pathway would be? And can you see a way that it might be implemented? May I put that to either of you?
Well, I mean, a recommendation of a test within 24 hours, follow up within 24 hours. I mean, that's the recommendation, bit of a pipe dream. I think me in central London, in one of probably the wealthiest areas, I think my follow-up probably took at least a week. Now, I was amazed it only took that. But to say 24 hours, I mean, that sounds very unrealistic.
I think they're suggesting a referral to echocardiography within 24 hours if you have a raised proBNP to sort of confirm a diagnosis of heart failure. Sunny, do you have any thoughts on this?
No, I think it's coming from a good place. I just think there needs to be more to this. And I think this is a point of interaction, and therefore you use this as an opportunity to connect, to evaluate and take further, rather than just have a spot diagnosis and that's it. And I think, to go back to what Lawrence has said before, it's about getting the whole of me right rather than just part of me right. And yes, BNP, great. First of all, people have to agree on thresholds of BNP. People have to agree on echo criteria. People have to agree that this is not going to be a postcode lottery. But does it go to the nub of the problem, or does it just affect a small, cog in this whole process? And I would suggest the latter, though, again, it's a helpful step in the right direction. I think very importantly, it shouldn't just be the BNP is what I'm getting. And I think once you've got BNP and you've got echo, that's fine. But I think the next steps are very important. I think once, specialist organizations and specialists in this area and clinicians and patients have all agreed on what your threshold should be, because, in Lancashire, it might be BNP of Z100. And in London and West London, where Lawrence is, it might be a fraction of that. And what bothers somebody up there doesn't bother somebody down here. And this unevenness needs to be smoothened out, basically. And we need where everybody's on the same page. Secondly, once you've done that, the journey doesn't stop there. It's not just about getting them a diagnosis of heart failure. It's about managing the entire patient. And I'm slightly, what I want to see is the emphasis is on early diagnosis, early intervention, better patient outcome. And part of those early diagnosis should be early diagnoses. It should be more than one diagnosis. And early intervention is early interventions leading to better outcome, because all of those conditions will go together to improving the patient outcome. To give the example of COPD, most people of COPD don't die of COPD. They die of a comorbidity. And the commonest comorbidity they have is ischemic heart disease and heart failure. So it just gives you an idea that, if I was just looking after COPD patient in terms of the airways and the lungs and the infections, I wouldn't get this completely right. If I'm looking after the atrial fibrillation and I'm looking after the ischemic heart disease and I'm getting the heart failure specialist to optimize them, and I'm looking at the anemia and I'm looking at the iron and I'm looking at reflux and the depressive, the psychological psychiatric elements and the skeletal muscle dysfunction and the renal complications and the bone health, if I get all that right, because, you know, Lauren said something that resonates hugely. If he increases his walking distance by a certain amount every day, and the heart is great for that, but say the muscles and the bone aren't, well, I can't get him to reach the target that he needs to reach, and I can't exceed it. So if the lungs aren't doing what they're supposed to do to support the rest of the body and so on, if the kidney function is not quite right, if the iron B12 folate isn't in the right place, if the vitamin D, and, you know, I've got to get the whole thing for him to feel the full benefit of what he can really achieve, you know? And by just going for one element, it just feels like I'm, you know, it's one part of the jigsaw, of a very big jigsaw, you know, and an important part. I'm not saying it's not important, but I think there's a very big picture here that we just need to be, you know, focusing on increasing the awareness. And very importantly, commissioners need to get behind this.
Yeah.
So patients get this.
And patients have to understand the interconnectivity of it all. And the fact that my heart is operated on and I've got the pacemaker and they've done what they can for my heart, but my heart relies upon my lungs to work effectively to oxygenate the blood. And my lungs rely upon my heart to circulate old blood back to be reoxygenated. And, you know, in one of my rehabs, I learned this thing of your legs are in actual fact your second heart. The more you walk, the more your heart gets supported by a sort of secondary mechanism, which helps pump blood around. But if you sit sedentary, you ain't going to get that chump. Your heart might be repaired, but your lungs won't get the extra help to oxygenate the blood because you're sitting still with a damage. Your heart's repaired, but it's still damaged. It's got to rebuild. It's got to remodel. They do. It's amazing. You pull an arm muscle or whatever, it's painful for a few days, but it remodels itself, or it gets back, goes back to normal, slots back to normal. Your heart isn't quite the same. I mean, but very simplistic terms, as a patient, it is much the same. You pull a muscle, it's very painful for a time. It goes back to some sort of normality. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sonny, but, you know, your legs help an incredible amount.
He's very eloquently vocalized this, and it's a message that I think needs to get out more and more. And the awareness of the way Lawrence puts it, I think, is resonates hugely with both me as a carer, whose, you know, close family relative went through a similar situation, as well as me as a professional who deals with this thing, you know, on a regular basis. And I think, having seen it from both sides, if you like, I think that makes a huge amount of sense. It's about patients understanding, as well as clinicians understanding, how interconnected everything is, and how by getting all the parts of that system optimized will lead to the overall better functioning and performance of that system, which is the body. And of course, it is the mind as well. You know, if you have better lungs, better heart, better cardiovascular system, better oxygen delivery, guess what? You'll focus better. Your concentration will feel better. Your well-being goes up. Maybe you do the crossword better. I don't know. Whatever it is, you can then, you know, if somebody has issues with diet, they can focus on them better. I mean, there's things that we haven't talked about: sleep, diet, strength training. But what I'm getting, and stress management. But very importantly, you can all do that if we've optimized all the parts of the system, because they then go to fulfilling you, if you like, and you can then use those to the best of your ability. If I've only given you 60%, well, that's the highest you're ever going to get, you know. Whereas if I give you 100%, then you can work towards achieving 100% of your fulfillment. If you say whatever your personal goals are, you've got a much better chance of getting them because all the bits are now connected and working in an operational fashion.
Yeah, and I mean, Sonny touches there on the psychological side. Definitely mindset from the patient's point of view, you know, a patient's mindset, a patient's positivity, is terribly important on the recovery process. And if they're terribly depressed and if they're very down and they hear the word heart problem, heart failure, heart attack, whatever it is, they think they're going to die. And people like Sunny and patients like me need to reassure them there is a life. You can cope with it. You know, obviously, we all know we've got to die at some stage. But, you know, it doesn't have to be immediate. It doesn't have to be an insurmountable struggle either.
And we can very well optimize a situation so that they're leading an excellent quality as well as improving the quantity of their life. Many people say to me, you know, I don't want to be breathless at this level all the time. And I say to them, we'll work towards it. And it's their awareness that this is possible. It's our awareness that we can do this. And also the fact that it isn't just always one thing that makes it happen. If you see what I'm saying, you've got to go through that multi-structured systematic evaluation that allows you to calibrate according to your patient. And that's what personalized care is about. And as you know, and the other bit that I often find that's forgotten, the other party is the carer. The people and they may not live with you. They may be people who are just your concerned people. You know, the people, they also need to be reassured that this is, a treatable condition. This is a modifiable condition, or conditions. I'm almost mistaken making my own, issue there, but or condition. And that actually, if we get it all right, they've got security, or they've got some reassurance inside them that they can do what they want to do and be the way they want to be with the person who's their loved one.
And also not smothering them with love and affection, because the patient still has to really do quite a bit for themselves. And if the carer, the companion, the partner is, you know, making the tea, rushing to pick the paper up when it's dropped on the floor, you know, doing the things which you see a carer doing and which carers believe they should be doing, it's not always that productive at the end of the day for the patient. The patient should be encouraged, not pushed, but encouraged to do things for themselves.
We've talked about there needing to be greater understanding, and that probably comes from education. Where is the greatest need for education in the system? We know that our people in primary care are beleaguered, but where does it start, and how do we spread the load, and how do we actually make sure that responsibility is taken from end to end?
Well, I mean, if I can add my thought processes here, I think it goes across the board. But very importantly, we've we should never stop educating ourselves as clinical professionals. That I'm always going to be part of, and it's part of my regular work as well. But I think where it's probably most needed, in my view, are the people in positions of authority. It is the commissioners who need to understand that there are models of care that can be delivered, and they need to make it happen. They need to commission it, because without it being commissioned, no one else will break the rules, if you like. And this is one of those situations where following the rules isn't always the right thing, if you see what I'm saying, for the patient. Mm-hmm. So commissioners need to make the rules fit around the patient rather than we try the other way around. And I think that would be a huge, huge breakthrough for freedom, really, a blow for freedom. The people who manage the healthcare services within each trust can then be empowered to say, look, these existing pathways, which are patient-centric, exist. And these are the metrics you need to hit. And Lawrence touched upon this at the beginning. Patients need to understand what the right metrics are, to understand what the right language is. Well, in the same way, it's important to educate the commissioners, the managers, as well as, you know, clinicians whose specialty it may not be, their primary specialty, as to what the right metrics are. I'm not saying that they have to be able to be, postgraduately qualified in every element of the condition, but you can definitely, outline what metrics need to be achieved, and what the gold standards are for those, and therefore what can be, you know, and put a composite, if you like, set of elements together. Quaff shows us that this can be done. I mean, general practice has been doing Quaff for years, and in Quaff you will find heart metrics and lung metrics and diabetic metrics and, you know, maybe vaccination and so on. In the same way, for a condition, for people who have a condition, you can have their own set of metrics, which can be well outside just that organ system. For COPD, it could be bone, heart, and of course, heart can be ischemic heart disease, can be heart failure, can be atrial fibrillation, can be cancer, can be skeletal muscle, can be psychiatric, etc. You can put the whole lot down, and therefore people can see, through integrating their health care, people can see exactly what's been achieved and what needs to be achieved, and therefore ensure that, you know, we get there. And the patients can be in control of that. The relatives can look at their own, their loved ones, if you like, performance sheet almost, to see how far they've got to and who needs to be, you know, called in to fix the muscle. You know, do they need a bit more strength training? Do they need a chat with a psychologist or local psychiatrist? Do they need an iron infusion? Whatever it happens to be, or do they need to go and see the heart failure nurse to go and sort out diuretics and medication? But it can then be a path that everybody gets a view on and can contribute to, and we can then move people forward in a, as you say, in a time sensitive manner. Some things can be done at the same time, if you like, that way you get people to be better faster.
Care planning, Sunny. Interestingly, last year there was a statistic that 6%, only 6% of people with heart failure in the community have a care plan. Be a good place to start to actually help patients build their own care plan and actually build the support around them.
And patients need to be reassured right from the outset that breathlessness and heart failure are conditions which can be coped with, can be improved in most cases. Not in all cases, but in most cases. And they need to be educated, it's not the right word, but they need to be shown, Sonny's right, a sort of a list of symptoms, or they need to be told a list of symptoms that if they feel they're getting worse, refer back to the GP, refer back to the cardiac nurse. And 9 times out of 10, that'll be referring back to the GP, who also must know more about the condition. The condition must be highlighted more to GPs, because bronchitis is not necessarily bronchitis, it can be heart failure.
And of course, vice versa. And of course, it might be 2 things to treat. It might be 3, you know, and I think that's such an important point Lawrence has made. If I can take that a step further, I'd like the GPs not to be, how shall I put it? At the moment, they are disincentivized to refer. And I think I'm married to a GP. So, you can imagine I get this firsthand. And I also have a lot of friends who are GPs. So it's close to my heart in many ways. They are disincentivized to refer. And that needs to be taken away. You need to be incentivized to get it right. And, you know, not getting it right should be the disincentive, not referring. If the right thing to do is refer, so be it. You know, rather than you've done too many, why did you refer this patient? No. There's a good reason for this, and we all agree on these thresholds, and that's absolutely fine, and it's national. You know, you want that sort of framework, whether you're in Cumbria, or you're in Portsmouth, or you're in the West Country, or you're in East Anglia, it should all be the same. It should all be the same, and that's what we have to work towards. And you know, organisations like BSH, etc., remarkable. You know, they can...
Should it all be the same, but it's all got to be at a realistic level. So rather than sort of say, here's the gold standard, we're all going to do that, let's set some very achievable minimum levels, yeah? And have those around the countryside. have those drilled into people, because like a children's building block frame, you start with the foundations, you get the foundations incorrectly, you can build on those over months, years, generations, but get those building blocks incorrectly.
There you go. You've had it straight from the person who's felt it first line. So absolutely get some minimum standards in. And, you know, if what was it says, perfection and excellence. So I aim for perfection, but I'll accept excellence. You know, let the minimum that I'm being aspirational, maybe, but I hope not. Let the minimum be excellent, you know, and let that be not just achievable, but I want the patients, what I really want is the patients to feel the benefit of those minimal clinical standards. It shouldn't be something that you just tick the box on. It has to be something that makes a demonstrable benefit to patients' life. So,
absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Putting us back to the population health theme, that's population health being an approach aimed at improving the health of an entire population in essence, but which requires taking that personal approach that you spoke of earlier, Sonny, optimizing and educating the individual as we've touched on, and taking into account the individual circumstances as a whole. I think we've covered that in this discussion, but how do we build that resilience, stamina, and improve the function to reduce breathlessness? What can doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals, and patients do?
Well, this is a multi-pronged approach, and one has to look at the whole system of care and your whole day. What is it you want to achieve? Where are you in life? Where do you want to get to? And where are you on that? On that platform, if you like, on that escalator. And there are certain key elements, you know, you've got to get sleep right. And sleep is so important, and we just don't pay it enough attention. Sleep is so crucial. We could do 3 hours on sleep and we'd still be here. It's so important to know the components of sleep and what proportions you need to get absolutely spot on to you know, improve your physical health, but your cognitive and your emotional health and the relative contributions of your, if you like, your sleep-wake cycle are very important to that. Diet, you can't say enough about diets. It, you know, can I really say to you that I get my protein levels absolutely spot on every day? I'd be sitting here with my nose growing, you know. We have to make sure that people understand exactly what it is you do with your diet and what the relative, you know, proportion of protein, carbohydrate, fat should be. And if you don't track it, you don't know what's happening. So you've got to monitor that and keep an eye on it. And, you know, every meal can be tracked. I've done this personally in the last year in the middle of COVID, and it's worked for me. So I can tell you, it's somebody who's had his head buried in COVID for the last 2 and a bit years. This is all possibly achievable. You know, exercise, graded and personalized. Lauren mentioned it right at the beginning, but it runs away through. But muscle strengthening, if you are stronger, and we're not talking about, you know, I'm dating myself to doing Jeff Capes and the, you know, and the strongman business. We're talking about improving your muscle strength, which will improve your balance and your mobility and your flexibility. It's about picking stuff up from the floor. And Lauren said it. Well, you know, if my back muscles are stronger, if my core is stronger, if my arm muscles are stronger, I'm less likely to have a fall. I'm more likely to be able to cope with a slip. You know, we have bad weather in the UK. You know what happens? The snow falls and everybody stops, you know, but people still walk outside and slip and fall, and the colles fractures go up and the fracture neck of femurs go up. You know, you could say, well, what was the point of me fixing your heart and lung and all the rest of it if you're going to slip over and fall over and bust your hip and then have that trouble? So it's about getting that bit right. And of course, it's about how you develop resilience, how you deal with the stresses of everyday life. And of course, if you're happy doing what you're doing and you have the strength, you know, if you've slept well, you've eaten well, you've walked around and feel better, you can cope with whatever comes to the door because you're in better shape to deal with it, you know. So that's my recipe for, you know, just normal everyday management. But I think it doesn't get enough publicity, and you know, certain elements will get more, and a little bit will get less depending on what's, you know, flavor of the month, etc. But I think as a composite formula for people to then personalize themselves into that and say what bit of it, you know, or what elements of it all pertain to me and how do I get it right for me, I think would improve population health, and actually it would probably take stress off the health service because people are actually self-managing themselves better, and you know, longer and healthier lives are then going to be lived.
Thank you, Sonny. Lawrence, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think resilience is such an important word. I mean, if you're resilient, you can attempt to get through most things. And I think if the doctors optimize the treatment, if the doctors and the patients optimize the medicines together, because there's an enormous path to go on to optimize medicines. The right level of medicines is terribly important for each individual, and that takes time. Then if those are optimized, then it really does fall to the patient to be resilient and build on what they have. And those can be very small steps, and you can take two steps forward and one step back. But if at the end of a period of a month, 2 months, 6 months, a year, you're feeling better, you're feeling more resilient because your blood's pumping better, your muscle tone's improved, everything is sort of clicking a bit better. Unfortunately for me, it may be a clicking bone of arthritis or, you know, something like that. But your system, you're feeling better. You're feeling more resilient. And you can cope with the future better. And you know, it is very definitely getting those small building bricks right, which small building bricks, forget that expression. Get the basics right. You know, the mechanics of your heart right, the mechanics of your body, get the medicines right, then you can start building.
Thank you. Well, it's been an extraordinary discussion. Thank you both. Do you have any final messages before we sign off?
There's probably one point that I haven't made, and I'd like Lawrence to have the last word on this, really. So I'll say my bit first, if I may. And it's just something that he triggered me to think about just now. And that is, if you're in better shape and you need an operation for something else, it could be a foot operation, could be a hip operation, could be a knee operation, then you are more likely to do better out of that operation because you're in better shape. And I think that's very important. I think to give an example, you know, we find that there are patients who perhaps are thought to be high risk because of their underlying comorbidities. Well, if those comorbidities are absolutely optimized, then it may be, and in many cases, this is what we do at Harefield, is we optimize the patients and they can still have their heart operation despite what comorbidities. And I think that would be great because it would give them better quality of life. And that leads me to the last message, which I think is very important, is that it's about the whole patient. You can call it complete care. I call it total body optimization. People have got different words for it, I guess, and synonyms. But the bottom line is we get the whole patient right. And if we do that, the effects on the whole of the health service will be, you know, amplified. They're less likely to present with acute. They're less likely with acute illnesses. They're less likely to be able to fight them off and deal with them. They're less likely to trouble if that's the right word, to contact the healthcare services for issues that could have been managed, you know, closer to home by them, because they're more resilient, because they are stronger, because they've been sleeping better, their diet's better. They can focus on getting the fine tuning right, because the basics that Lawrence has talked about are already in place. They can now start refining themselves to getting to where they need to get to. And I think you know, once we've got the big blocks in place, once all that's been sorted, the patients can then take control. And you know, it's more about being a person than it is about being a patient. And we want them to restore themselves to being a normality rather than people who come and to outpatients every 3-6 months, etc. It should be a, you know, they need to lead their lives rather than as people rather than as patients is what I think I'd leave you with as a message.
Thank you, Sunny. Lawrence, the final word to you.
I'd just love to say a big thank you to all the medical profession. And my favourite heroes, the cardiac nurses in particular. And in the last 4 years, I've met 4 grandchildren. And I wouldn't have met them but for the medical profession. And I'm really very, very humbled and very grateful for everything that's done. And I mean, resilience is so important, and learning from doctors is great, but very often a lot of the things I learn are from other patients. Patients' experiences, feedback, and mutual support is terribly important.
Thank you, Lawrence. Well, thank you. Thank you both for your time and your thoughts. This is touching on a huge subject, which I'm sure we will continue to discuss as we start to understand how to take a personal, individualized approach to the wider determinants of population health. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sunny.
You too.
Thank you, Janine.
So I'm